Hello and welcome to National League Town, Mets fandom, Mets history, Mets life, with Long Island's own Greg Prince and Jeff Heisen. Hey, Greg.
Greetings from the warmth of Long Island this summer day, Jeff.
On today's show, the third base coach is waving you in as we talk about Keith Hernandez. But first, the Mets acquired Keith Hernandez in a big midseason trade. The trade deadline is August 2nd, and a lot of the speculation is about Wilson Contreras. So I'm going to lay out pros and cons, and then we're going to discuss whether the Mets should attempt to trade for Wilson Contreras. And that's Wilson with two L's, by the way. So here are some pros. McCann and Nito can't hit. They are almost automatic outs. I'm surprised whenever they get a hit. Half the time I groan when I see them coming up to bat. Getting Contreras turns your worst lineup spot into one of your best with much needed power. He is a huge upgrade to the lineup. Overall, and all statistics are as of Tuesday afternoon, Contreras is a plus 2.7 WAR this year. McCann is only a plus 0.2, and Nito is a negative 0.2. Contreras provides power in a lineup that needs power. He has, as of now, 13 home runs, while the Mets catchers have hit two, and one of them was by Mazzica, who's in the minors. Buster Olney at ESPN wrote, while the Mets are third in the National League in runs per game, they rank just 11th in home runs, relying on a lot of timely hitting to boost the attack, so they really do need another hitter. Tim Britton in The Athletic noted that the Mets have 78 home runs in 80 games. This is an outdated number, but the point was teams don't make the playoffs if they have fewer than one home run a game. And that was before the expanded playoffs, but the Mets are short on power and Contreras can help alleviate that deficiency. He can DH and he would be an improvement over J.D. Davis, unfortunately. I like J.D. And the last pro, if you're going to go for it, you get him. Okay, so Greg, those are pros. Let's talk about cons. He's a half-year rental for a top 10 prospect because that's what he's going to cost. And it's only a half-year rental. There is no chance of re-signing him as there was with Javi Baez because Alvarez will be here soon. If not this year, then next year. The Mets are trying to cultivate top prospects, not trade more of them away. They've already traded Kelenic and Pete Crow Armstrong. Contreras is not as good a defender as Nito or even McCann. Don't just take my word for it. I spoke with our friend Mark Simon of Sports Info Solutions, and he's a good Twitter follow, by the way, at Mark A. Simon Says. And he says to me that Wilson Contreras' defensive strength is that he's good at throwing behind runners and picking them off. He's declined in throwing out base stealers the past couple of years, although that could be the fault of his pitchers. Through 2020, though, he was better than both Nito and McCann. He's not now. Simon tells me that his weakness is pitch framing. McCann and especially Nito haven't beat there. He's had good years and he's had bad years, and he's had years where he's been average as far as pitch blocking. Nito has been really good at that this year. McCann's average may be a little below. In sum, Mark Simon tells me he's maybe a little better than McCann. I don't think he's close to Nito. Batting-wise, as far as his WOBA, which is a version of on-base percentage that accounts for how a player reached base, in Contreras' last three full-length seasons, his WOBA was 33 points lower from July 1 forward than it was before. So he has a track record of a second-half performance decline. And finally, as a con, this could be disruptive to the veteran pitching staff that seems to like pitching to McCann and Nito. So, Greg, what do you think?
I think we're talking about a trade that's probably not going to happen, but that's okay. That's what the pre-trade deadline period is for weighing these things. And he's obviously a sexy name in the context of what we as baseball fans consider sexy. I think it's interesting that Mark Simon was not a fan of his pitch framing skills. I know Mark looks at pitch framing pretty seriously. I had done a wee bit of research myself and had come across an article from 2020, again, that weird half a year, not even half a year, and said he had become one of the best pitch framers in the game and was saving Cubs pitchers two runs versus what an average pitcher was saving. But apparently that was a fleeting improvement. And it puts me in mind of hitting the market at the right time is pretty important for a catcher, because when James McCann came on the market, he was coming off his really one terrific year, and he was the consolation prize for teams that did not go out and sign JT Realmuto. And we've seen with McCann, who has his strengths defensively, and he's a catcher. I just want to keep coming back. We're talking about a position where defense and not just fancy looking stuff in highlight reels is the most important thing. McCann hasn't been that offensive player, and he may not have been that defensive player, but he's getting it done as far as the pitchers are concerned. And I think we've seen with Nito getting it done where the pitchers are concerned. The only part of the period where McCann was out, we had to rely mostly on Nito and a little on Mazzica, putting aside the offense, was some dissonance with Chris Bassett, and Chris Bassett put that on himself, said I needed to work with these guys. So I think I've already stopped talking about Wilson Contreras since you asked me. I'm having a hard time imagining, putting aside the chances of getting him, that you bring in a catcher in the middle of a pennant race to be your primary catcher. The only time the Mets have done something like that in memory is when they got a fellow named Mike Piazza, which was a big upgrade, certainly offensively, in 1998. But the season wasn't that far in at that point, and the Mets actually didn't really have what you would call an incumbent because Todd Hundley was on the shelf. So I didn't think it was any problem bringing in Mike Piazza for a staff that wasn't throwing to anybody in particular at that point. Wilson Contreras has had a good track record in Chicago. I've seen where young pitchers have credited him for instilling them with confidence. Kyle Hendricks, who watched him develop, said he just really knows what to say, when to push a guy, when to take him to the side. He's really good on that vocal aspect. The thing is that what we need? No, we need hitting. Would he come here and say, all right, we're looking to you to be the final piece of the puzzle? Would that go over with him? I really don't know. I don't know him well enough. I mean, I'm aware of Wilson Contreras. We haven't seen the Cubs this year yet. I'm going to be watching extra close when we go to Wrigley Field. He's got a World Series ring, not by accident either. But I'm still having a hard time imagining just inserting a starting catcher, even one of his caliber, suddenly going to be here. And there is what it would take, as you said. You know, we're not trading our best catching prospect to get Wilson Contreras, and we don't have enough other prospects to feel really good about letting one go. I thought last year's deal, and we're always kind of haunted by the last thing we saw, of Pete Crow Armstrong, essentially, to get Javi Baez and Trevor Williams. That was a lot to give up. At the time, I didn't mind because I thought Baez filled a need and made the team better. Whether he did or not is a matter for debate. I'm sure Contreras, if all worked out, would make the team better. Is it worth giving up somebody like Vientos? And I'm just throwing that name out there. I'm not a minor league maven. I don't feel we have to do it. I think I want to get back to the main point of what he brings, this power. I think the Mets are going to be fine with power. I think we've seen in the last week Eduardo Escobar heat up. We've seen Starling Marte start to go deep. We've seen Lindor start hitting home runs again. And Alonso is going to obviously hit his share. The weather is changing. Balls will carry. I don't worry about the bulk of this lineup. Even Smith and Davis have been showing signs of being the hitters we thought they would be. All of which is to say, if all of these guys are doing their job as sluggers occasionally, we can have catchers who the pitchers enjoy throwing to, who the pitchers have no complaint about largely. And yeah, they're going to be, I don't want to say automatic outs, but they're going to be outs a little more often than we wish. And when there's two outs and with the number 9 spot is up in the order, and it's like, oh boy, here we go, we're going to be disappointed. But I think on balance, we're going to be okay. This seems like a pretty big move to make, that unless it gets really tight in the National League East, and unless both of these guys do not get it together, meaning Nito and McCann, I just don't see it happening. And I don't see a need for it. Again, if they're going to drop off Contreras on our front doorstep with a note saying, thank you for taking his contract, we don't really need anything else, hey, bring him on. But this is not one of those names in the paper or names on Twitter where I'm saying, oh, yes, we got to go get him. So I appreciate the idea. I appreciate that it's out there. I appreciate that Mets can always use help. Even a first place team can use help. Man, I just don't see it.
Neither do I. I'd love to see him in the lineup because of the power, but I'm concerned about how it would affect the pitching staff. I'm sure that Scherzer has an opinion about that and will let Billy Epler know. And I'm sure Buck's seen this type of situation during his years in baseball and will let Billy Epler know. I don't see it happening, especially at the cost of a top 10 prospect. I hope that they address the power off the bench in some other respects, unless they think that JD and Dom can start hitting some bombs.
Of course, there's about a month, maybe a little less to go before the trade deadline, and the world will spin many times on its axis. Whatever it is the world does in 24 hours, I'm getting my astronomy all kerfuffled, as they say. But what I'm saying here is a lot can change, and who knows what names will come up, will be shot down, and will sneak in. God knows, on June 14th, 1983, there was a name that was not on our minds as coming to the Mets.
So we'll see what happens. But for now, Greg and I, about a Wilson Contreras trade, give it two thumbs down. And with that, the balcony is closed. So let's talk about number 17 as the Mets get ready to retire his number this Saturday. I want to tell you a little story. In 2009, I went to fantasy camp, and I'm not saying that as a brag or a flex, as the kids say. When you go to fantasy camp, you get to pick your own uniform number, and I picked 17. So a few days into camp, the campers know the Mets players know us. We become more comfortable with each other. I'm walking by wearing my 17 uniform. Pete Shorek is sitting with Felix Mian. Felix Mian asks me, "Jeff, did you pick 17 for me?" And I fumfered around for a second, and I said, "For you and Keith." And Shorek looks at him and says, "It wasn't for you, Felix. It was for Keith Hernandez." Yes, it was. Let's talk about Keith Hernandez.
Let's talk about Keith, baby. Oh, boy. Keith Hernandez. Like I said, June 14th, 1983, we were just going about our business. And if the trade deadline was big news then, it wasn't big news because we thought that, hey, you know what's going to happen tomorrow? The Mets are going to get the player who's going to change their fortunes for the rest of this decade. Prior to June 15th, 1983, Keith Hernandez was a very good player for the St. Louis Cardinals. He was more than a very good player. As Marty Noble put it in Newsday the day after June 15th, 1983, few players earn the distinction. Tom Seaver did in his first tour at the Mets. He became the franchise. Steve Carlton is regarded that way with the Phillies. Keith Hernandez was the Cardinals franchise, and now he is the Mets' first baseman. Yes, he was that important a player in his old base of operations. Sometimes he helped beat the Mets. In those days, everybody helped beat the Mets prior to June 15, 1983, as Keith himself doesn't seem to mind reminding us whenever he speaks about his pre-Met career. But he was one of the more elite players in the National League to make an unwelcome habit of doing the Mets in. We know he was co-most valuable player in the National League in 1979 with Willie Stargell. We know he won a batting title that year. We know he began his endless collection of gold gloves in the late 70s. And we know, because it also comes up when he speaks, that he delivered the biggest blow for the Cardinals when they won the 1982 World Series. We also knew we didn't want to see him come up in the ninth inning against one particular Met. On May 24th, 1981, a Sunday afternoon in St. Louis, a fellow named Mike Scott was protecting a 1-0 shutout for the Mets as Keith led off the ninth. The shutout was over with one swing. Somehow the Mets hung on to the tie and won in the 10th. Another fellow, Neil Allen, tripled for the Mets and got the win. A little over a year later, another Sunday in St. Louis, another one-run lead for Scott. Keith, like his future acquaintances Cosmo Kramer and Newman, was enjoying a beautiful afternoon in the right field stands, metaphorically at least. Whitey Herzog had given him the day off at Busch Stadium, but on this Sunday, June 20th, 1982, Herzog called on Hernandez to pinch hit against Scott with two out and nobody on. Keith again went deep off the Met righty and again tied the game. And again, in the interest of accurate narrative spoiling, the Mets came back to win in the 10th, this time with Jesse Orozco getting the win for you fans of foreshadowing. Keith had all Met pitching well, batting 292 in 127 games against his NL East rivals from New York. By 1983, Mike Scott, against whom Hernandez hit more home runs than any other pitcher he ever faced, was no longer on the Mets. That would have been the only reason to not go out and get Keith when he became available, since we no longer had the one guy he reliably killed. But we got him anyway, and I think it's safe to say history judges the Keith Hernandez trade a very good idea. Incidentally, Keith didn't homer off Mike Scott in the 1986 playoffs, but he did take our nemesis deep in a regular season game versus the Astros in April of 1987 and single in what became the difference in a 2-1 win that night at Shea. So despite the collective consensus that we couldn't dare to try to beat Mike Scott in hypothetical Game 7 of the 1986 NLCS, so we damn well better win Game 6, I swear to you, I think Keith would have found a way to get us through it.
One of many things about Keith that sticks with me is the gravitas he brought to the team. Do you think that there are other Mets that have done that, or do you think that in Mets history, Keith is unique?
SNY is running a documentary right now called He's Keith Hernandez, good name. And Ron Darling talks about the difference Keith made and compares it to the difference Tom Seaver made in 1967 in terms of showing the way for a team that had done nothing but lose. And I thought that was a pretty savvy comparison. And the Mets have gone out and made trades before to make statements, to add talent. But gravitas is a great word where Keith Hernandez is concerned. Now, you could say there was not a lot of need for gravitas in the middle of June 1983. The Mets just needed somebody, anybody, to play baseball better. It is no exaggeration to say that they were the Pits. They had been the Pits for 7 years, but 1983, they'd gotten off to a horrible start. They brought up Darryl Strawberry early, certainly earlier than they wished to. And while it was exciting to get glimpses of Darryl Strawberry, they were still a horrible team. The manager, George Bamberger, adiosed in early June. Frank Howard was kind of watching the store, and the Mets were going nowhere, which is where they had lived since 1977. And Keith Hernandez was just a totally different animal and not just a different brand of fowl, a cardinal. Keith Hernandez was in the game. I'm going to do something that I hate admitting that I'm going to do. I'm going to quote myself here. A little something I wrote a while ago. The Mets ran this ticket special in the 1980s that was incredibly successful. For the price of one admission, you could see the most fearsome competitor in the game, a peerless clutch hitter, and first base play that was revolutionary as it was nonpareil. They were also willing to throw in for that one ticket a consistent 300 hitter, a guy who ran the game like a point guard, and a window into the mind of the most intelligent player you'd ever see or hear. Oh, and if that wasn't enough to lure you in, you'd watch somebody who was looked up to by almost all of his teammates, experience the hit that turned around Game 7 of the World Series, and if you requested it, the secondhand effects from a stream of Marlboros. Actually, you got the cigarettes, whether you wanted them or not. Still in all, a really great deal. The Mets sold a lot of baseball with that package, especially in 86. It was an incredible deal. So it was the one they made in 83 that made it possible. I wrote that in 2005, early in our Faith and Fear time, about a ballplayer who left the Mets in 1989. I thought it described the Keith Hernandez experience in a nutshell, accurately 16 years after the fact, and an appropriate 17 years later. I believe it holds up. The word that comes to mind most immediately now for me is intense. Keith Hernandez was intense. Intensity practically oozed through the screen, whether you're watching on Channel 9 or Sports Channel, or those occasions when the game was on NBC or ABC. Keith was where the game lived. Keith was where the Mets of his era lived. First base, the batter's box, the shots of the dugout. It's great and telling that he was named captain. But he didn't really need the title or the C for you to know the Mets of that era were Keith Hernandez's team.
Last night after the game was over, I looked in vain for the SNY documentary on Keith because it's not available to those of us who don't have an SNY subscription. But I found 5 minutes of Keith highlights. And yes, intense is a great way to describe him. Think about the play he made that famous, not infamous, famous night in Cincinnati when he came in on that bunt as if he knew he was positive it was going to be bunted. And Cincinnati still bunted it. Keith could have been decapitated if they hit a line drive his way. But he came in, fielded it beautifully, and threw it to Gary Carter at third base. What? Gary Carter was at third base? Yes, you have to know the whole game to understand why Gary Carter was at third base, who threw a strike to first base. And Keith pumped his fist. Intense is a great word to describe him.
And Keith was closer to the batter as Jesse Orosco went into his motion than Jesse Orosco was. So he had moved at least 31 feet, shall we say, from his position at first base. I've often thought of those 1986 Mets as the team with the most personality, or perhaps personalities, of any Mets team I've ever lived through. The deeper I get into thinking about them, I wonder if I'm mostly just thinking about Keith. Listen, the other players, beyond producing on the field, could be fascinating off the field, at least as we as fans processed what they had to say and how they tended to act in those days, especially as it appeared in the papers and sounded coming from the descriptions of our announcers, especially Tim McCarver. The 1986 Mets were very much a collection of personalities, and they indeed dripped with personality. But I also think about a brief exchange from Pulp Fiction that culminates in the Wolf, played by Harvey Keitel, telling Raquel, played by Julia Sweeney, "Just because you are a character doesn't mean you have character." Keith Hernandez was definitely a character as much as anybody who formed the cast that captivated New York. But man, did he have character. He was the guy you wanted to be up in the clutch. He was the guy you wanted the ball hit to. He was the guy who, if he wore a path from first base to the pitcher's mound, you were certain was going to whisper the right advice in the pitcher's ear, and we were going to get out of the inning.
There was one game I remember going to with my father at Shea Stadium. I remember Keith making a great play, so it could have been any game. But I remember my father watching that play. We were sitting in the field boxes behind first base, and my father watched Keith and said, "That's the best fielding first baseman I've seen since Gil Hodges." And that was high praise. When we were preparing for the show, I tried to figure out what game that was. And I knew that was the same day that the Cubs and the Cardinals played a crazy game on NBC, Ryan Sandberg or something. I really don't care, but I know it was the same day. So I Googled that, and that led me to June 23rd, 1984. Mets 2, Expos nothing. By the way, the Expos, the top four in their lineup that day, Tim Raines, Pete Rose, Andre Dawson, Gary Carter.
Nice collection.
Bruce Bereni got the win. Doug Sis got the save. And Greg sent me some newspaper accounts of that game. Sis couldn't have done it without the Daily Dilly from Hernandez, the gold glove first baseman. Tim Raines slashed a low bullet headed towards right field, but Hernandez dove for the ball and speared it, and while still on his knees, fired a soft strike to second to get the lead runner. But wait, Hernandez was not finished. When Pete Rose followed with a bouncer to short and Jose Oquendo stepped on second, the shortstop then fired in the dirt to first. Not to worry, Hernandez was there to scoop it out and complete the double play. After the game, the Mets were effusive in their praise of Keith. Bruce Bereni, who was only making a second start as a Met, said, "I've seen more great plays since I've been here than I've ever seen. I think everyone knows how great Keith is." Davey Johnson says, "What can I tell you? He's the greatest. We'll see that all year, though, not just today." And Keith himself said, probably while taking a drag on a cigarette, "Well, I went out and made the play. You can contribute in the field defensively as well as offensively. I didn't come through offensively, but I had the chance to make the play and keep them out of the big inning." Just a random game. I happened to be there with my father, but it showed you at any day, and that was 1 year into the Keith Hernandez tenure with the Mets, what he was doing for the Mets.
Murray Heisen was a good scout defensively. Davey Johnson was a good scout defensively. Best first baseman any of us have ever seen. And he was contributing defensively that day. He contributed offensively an awful lot. There are two at bat in Keith's Met career, just two among 3,164 in the regular season that jump out at me. One didn't work out, one did. The unsuccessful one I'm thinking about came on August 14th, 1985. The Mets had been as hot as I'd ever seen them, winning 30 of their previous 37 games, squeezing past the Cardinals into first place. Keith had played in 36 of those games and had batted .386 with 40 RBIs. This night, the Mets and Phillies would go to the bottom of the ninth, the Phillies ahead 2-0. Mets seemed pretty dead, but the Mets were never dead at this point in 1985. They got a run in. They loaded the bases with one out, and up steps Keith Hernandez to face Don Carmen, a name, by the way, I can only hear in my head if Harry Callis is saying it. Don Carmen. Anyway, Keith's going to win the game, obviously. But somehow, Keith crowns into a 4-6-3 double play. Game over. Mets lose 2-1. Though the Mets were perfectly capable of losing a baseball game even in the summer of 1985, it seemed impossible to me that Keith Hernandez up with the tying run and winning runs on base and less than two out, that they would just be done. That didn't happen when Keith came up in a situation like that. Keith's reaction afterwards was, "I'm just mad." I didn't get mad at Keith Hernandez, but I was astonished. And I'm still astonished. We're talking, what, 37 years later, and I still can't. It's not I can't get over it. I just can't believe that Keith didn't get the game-winning hit that night. 3 years later, though, there was a happier outcome. The Mets were playing those pesky Pirates in the opener of a four-game series on the road. Those Pirates were more than pesky, to be honest. The Mets were supposed to be running away with the division in 1988, but Pittsburgh stayed on their heels, partly because the young Bucks were very talented with Barry Bonds and Bobby Bonilla before he became a Day, and yeah, they were well managed by Jim Leland. And they were still in it, partly because the veteran Mets were somewhat compromised. Keith had been out with a hamstring injury since June. You hear him talk about it to this day, the way you can't come back too soon from a hamstring, Gar. He speaks from experience. He was out long enough as it was, and the Mets faltered in his absence. But eventually Keith healed, he returned to Three Rivers Stadium, and we were reminded of who and what we'd been missing. Keith comes up in the first inning for the first time in more than 6 weeks, and he doubles off Bob Walk to set up the first run of the game. In the seventh, it's 1-1, which seemed to be the score of every Mets game that stiflingly hot summer, and Keith has his favorite waterfowl, a duck on the pond. Wally Backman is on second. Dave Rucker, a lefty, has come in to face Keith, and Keith homers. The Mets go on to win the game, 3-2. They win the series 3-1, and before long, they pull away from the Pirates and they win the division. Keith was the missing ingredient that night, 1988, just as he had been right up to June 15, 1983. Moreover, Keith was the security blanket for this team and for us fans whenever things felt dicey. We clung to Keith. We still cling to that image of Keith as the guy who's going to come through the way we know he will. Or if he doesn't, you know what? He'll come through next time because, yeah, he's Keith Hernandez. We've been talking about Keith Hernandez, the player. Something we should respect about Keith Hernandez, the announcer, who feels like Keith Hernandez more than once removed from Keith Hernandez, the player. Keith Hernandez, the announcer, cares. The first couple of years of SNY, and for that matter, those years when he dabbled in broadcasting on MSG, I have to be honest, I had a hard time piecing together the Keith I remembered in uniform with the guy in the booth. The guy in the booth bordered on goofy. That, along with our memories of him, though, became his ticket to ride. People loved this goofy character who he had made himself out to be, and they remembered that once upon a time he was this very intense character. It took me a while to realize that Keith, who I treasured from the middle of the 1980s, intensity personified, Mr. Gravitas, couldn't continue to exist as a broadcaster. He couldn't exist as a human being that way. His head would have exploded. What it took me a long time to figure out was that Keith, the ballplayer, the Mex figure he carved out for himself, was a role he had to perfect to achieve what he did on the field. Mellow Keith, goofy Keith, maybe a nicotineless Keith, thank goodness he stopped smoking, might not have hit 310 every year or led the league in game-winning RBIs, as dubious as a statistic as that might have been. What I think we've experienced since 2006 is closer to the real Keith Hernandez, or at least the one he's chosen to present to us. By the way, it's a testament to what intriguing figure he is in whatever incarnation that he invites such analysis from the sidelines. When I say he cares, I've watched a few games recently specifically to listen to how he attacks the game as a broadcaster. Everything he sees when he's concentrating is of utmost importance to him. On the Friday night, the Mets faced Sandy Alcantara in Miami. Gary Cohn noted Sandy was warming up in front of the pitching rubber. Keith was astonished as I was when Keith didn't drive in those runs in 1985. "I've never seen that before," he repeated a couple of times. It had really gotten to his ballplayer's mind. What was a terrific pitcher like Alcantara doing and why was he doing it? Keith had watched so many pitchers warm up in his life, yet here was somebody going about it differently. He may check out for a pitch here or a pitch there, but he's never not appreciating the game when he has eyes on it. The first inning went on like that. Why was the center fielder shaded this way? Why is the base runner taking a lead that large? What's the hitter looking for on 1-2? Another game recently, he did a deep dive into how he used to wait on one knee in the on-deck circle and how that helped him prepare for his upcoming at-bat. And he compared it to what each current Met do up that inning was doing by way of standing and watching the pitcher. It was more fascinating than you'd suspect. It's easy enough to get caught up in his stories of what Haji is up to, or his explanations of having to wait around for the alarm guy to come to his house, or his inevitable dismay that, oh, I'm going to hit traffic if this game doesn't end soon. But deep down, He's still the ball player we can't get enough of. That's why he's welcome into our heads. He has a lifetime pass there, as far as I'm concerned. Of course, can't talk about Keith, the announcer, the player, the icon, without mentioning one more time, Seinfeld. And of course, Seinfeld made Keith a bit of a cartoon character, or at least gave him the platform to let us think of him that way. But I want to heartily endorse the casting choice Jerry Seinfeld made more than 30 years ago. That lady in the unemployment office who won't extend George Costanza's benefits, she was all of us in the way she had that ball on her desk autographed by the 1986 Mets, and her claim that she didn't miss a game that year, and that she was willing to suspend the rules if George could produce Keith Hernandez in her office in an hour. All of us who were in this city, Long Island included, in 1986, related to what it meant to simply grab a glimpse of Keith Hernandez on the street or in a restaurant or the locker room of a health club, perhaps. He was, if you've ever seen the movie Down with Love, our version of Catcher Block, played by Ewan McGregor. Man's man, ladies' man, man about town. Even if that wasn't a role Keith sought out exactly, it was what he represented to us. He was the best of us from a Mets fan's perspective. He was who we wished the Mets to be. He's the reason we were champions. That, I'm convinced, is how we see it. We stand by that to this day. And yeah, it's why we'll stand and applaud when 17 is revealed in the rafters on July 9th. I think we're honoring Keith Hernandez, the Met player who was here for 7 years. We're honoring the Met announcer who we've loved since 2006. We're putting up the number, honoring the aura, honoring the icon. I think it's a lifetime achievement award in many ways. We both could have looked up a lot more numbers, a lot more statistics. We didn't have to. You don't have to when it comes to Keith Hernandez. Those are there if you want to go look at them. The video clips are there, and treat yourself, of course, to July 22nd, 1986, and the double play that Jeff described. You know where to find the World Series videos. You know where to find Game 7. You know where to find Game 6 in Houston. The guy is a legend. Legend to us, specifically. A baseball legend. He's an announcing legend. And yes, I'm going to say it again. We say it too often, but it's true. He's Keith Hernandez. He's number 17. What did the Beatles say? She was just 17. Well, this guy is 17. No just about it. As great a Met, not named Tom Seaver, as there's ever been. And I'm just thrilled that 17's finally going up there.
And that's why I wore 17. Sorry, Felix Mian. From the day of the trade, Keith established a presence. And through Seinfeld and every night in the booth, it continues. That's why, again, he's Keith Hernandez.
You mentioned the booth again. You know what I love? Watch for it the next time they're opening the broadcast. And especially if it's just Gary and Keith. Gary will say, "Welcome to Citi Field tonight. The Mets are playing whoever they're playing." He'll set it up. And then Keith will come in and start talking, as Keith Hernandez will. Gary Cohn has this look on his face. He's looking at Keith, and then he's looking at us, and his expression says, "Can you believe that I get to sit next to Keith Hernandez? Can you believe that we all get to listen to Keith Hernandez? Isn't it just a nightly thrill that Keith Hernandez is still a part of this franchise, and that I, Gary Cohn, get to call him my friend and colleague?" Now, mind you, I've never heard Gary say that exactly, but it's just the warmth that kind of emanates from the presence in the booth that they share. The two of them, along with Ron Darling, are such a fixture in our lives. And not just because they're familiar and not just because two of them were really good players in their day. Here's something that I discovered. It's a discovery, but it's something I noticed. The Mets are retiring Keith Hernandez's number 32 years since he last played a baseball game for Cleveland, as it happened. The Pirates retired Ralph Kiner's number 32 years after he finished his playing career. He was no longer on Pittsburgh at the time. And I think there's a parallel to be drawn here. Ralph had a lot more importance to the Pirates in his career than he did to New York, because he was not a player in New York. But they both wound up in the booth in New York. And I think for many years, it's easy enough to sort of take for granted that they were here and that they're, you know, the malaprops in Ralph's case were funny and Keith's weird little asides are funny. But they both knew the game really well. They were both larger than life within the game. And the more you listened, even again, if modernity sometimes seems to have passed Keith by a little bit, and maybe Ralph was not at the cutting edge of the analytical evolution either, always learn something listening to these guys. And it's, I think it's a real privilege for us as fans to have guys like those explain baseball to us. And again, no, we're talking about the announcing part of it. But I think that's really a part of why 17 is up there. Maybe if Keith only came back once in a while after his playing career ended, it wouldn't have felt urgent to put 17 up there, but he's around all the time. And we were kind of wondering, like, why isn't 17 up there? You know, I'm sure you weren't the only one in fantasy camp, certainly in the history of fantasy camp, to choose 17. And with all due respect to Felix Mion and Rod Gasper and Ellis Valentine and Jerry Morales and any number of guys who wore 17 before 1983, I'm pretty sure the flock of 17s on middle-aged backs in Port St. Lucie was attributable largely to Keith Hernandez. Just holds such a special spot in this franchise lore, in this fan base's psyche. Just so happy to think about Keith Hernandez. You know, I think there is a sense you just take for granted the guy's on TV every night. Why did he miss that play? Why did he say weird thing he just said? But my God, what a great player.
Another number 17, Teddy Martinez.
Teddy Martinez wore number 17 before we realized that 17 shouldn't be worn by anybody else. Of course, 17 kept getting worn by others after 1989 until 2010, and some good players got 17, and at least one, David Cohn, wore it because of Keith Hernandez. There's a weird separation process franchises seem to have to do with non-super obvious we must retire his number types. The fact that number 8 got given out, number 36 got given out, and hey, number 17 got given out. I'm glad that that stopped after a while, even if it kind of took Keith bringing it up on the air once in a while to make sure everybody knew where he stood on the side of number 17 being retired. But he was right. And all, again, all due respect to the likes of Fernando Tatis and Mike Bordick and everybody who's worn 17 since 1989, this is Keith's number. And it's going to look awfully good up there alongside 36 and 31 and 41 and 14 and 37. And yeah, 42 and a little microphone icon for Ralph Kiner and the word Shay. So he's in the pantheon, no doubt about it.
Congratulations to Keith. We can't wait for Saturday. By the way, the actress that played the unemployment office person who loved the Mets, her name was Ray Allen. She passed away this year. She was also seen in A League of Their Own, which came out the same year as the boyfriend episode of Seinfeld. So there's a baseball connection with her from 1992. And now I'm getting far afield, and this is irrelevant to this conversation, but the actress that played the unemployment office person's daughter, who George had to go out with, the actress's name was Carol Ann Soucy, who can be heard multiple times a day in Big Bang Theory as the voice of Howard Wolowitz's mother.
And did Frank Cashin ever make a bigger bang than when he sent Neil Allen and Rick Ownby to the St. Louis Cardinals for Keith Hernandez?
Excellent coda for this episode. And that'll do it for another episode of National League Town. If you want to get in touch with us, we're on Gmail, nationalleaguetown@gmail.com. We're also on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We'll see you next week. Until then, I'm Jeff Heisen.
I'm Greg Prince.
And as always, let's go Mets. Copyright 2022, music provided by the Royal Arctic Institute. Check them out on Bandcamp.